WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at FairToFlare.com. I am Jason Mann, and joining me again is Will Pruitt of ProWrestling.net. Will, how you doing?
I'm well. You know, you always say hello like you're surprised.
Yeah, it's just kind of my thing.
Okay. Just, I don't know if you had noticed it or if you did it on purpose, so I like it.
Yeah, it just, I don't know. It's become my call. Like I feel like I need a better, closing for the show more than anything. My intro is okay, but my closing just always kind of feels like it falls flat. So, but I've never come up with a better one. So what can you do? Yeah. So today we are talking about the main event of Survivor Series 2002, and it is the very first Elimination Chamber match. It is a Triple H against Shawn Michaels, Rob Van Dam, Chris Jericho, Kane, and Booker T.
Yep.
Yes, that is the match. Kind of the setup for this is Eric Bischoff's idea. They were really kind of emphasizing SmackDown and Raw trying to top each other because this is just a few months after the brand split. That was in March or April of 2002. And they really kind of hit the reset button pretty quickly by bringing in Bischoff, putting him in charge of Raw, having Heyman be in charge of SmackDown. Doing a lot of reshuffling with the rosters and then splitting up the titles after they would basically unify them, you know, just a few months before.
I think actually, Stephanie was general manager of SmackDown at this point.
Oh, okay. Heyman became it later, I guess.
Yeah, he would go on to be.
Okay. He would be it later after Stephanie. I feel like at one point it was, you know, ECW and WCW general managers of the WWE shows. Okay, so
yeah,
so it was Stephanie. My mistake. But anyway, the point being is that, you know, they had done a lot in this 2002, in those few months, to kind of completely reshuffle the landscape of WWE.
Yeah, they had done a lot, and this match actually came about as the direct response. Eric Bischoff was obsessing over needing something to top the Brock Lesnar versus Undertaker Hell in a Cell match.
Right, which is a
fantastic
match.
At No Mercy.
Yeah.
It is a fantastic match, and we should do that one someday. But they were trying to top that match, and so it almost looked like Eric Bischoff was going to go for War Games, and then he swerved us with the Elimination Chamber.
Right, which was kind of billed as like a combination of the Survivor Series, War Games, and I guess Hell in the Cell or a cage match. I remember like and I really do think the Elimination Chamber is a great concept for a match.
I love it. I really do.
I do. I think having two of them on a show like they do now is a little bit much. Although it makes for great shows, but it is a really fun concept.
Yeah, it's a fun concept. It has all the fun of counting down, which yes. I think is really nice in a match when you can allow the fans to count down.
Right.
It also just, I don't know, there's something about it. There's a real excitement to it, and there's just the sheer spectacle of the giant chamber.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah,
it's neat.
The steel ramps and all that. I mean, that really is, you can do a lot with that. In the pods, and throwing guys in the pods or going on top of the pods. And they do a lot. They work a lot of that stuff in this very first match.
Yeah. And one of the fun things about this show is that in the pre-show, they never showed you the chamber. You saw like blueprints, but you never quite knew what it was going to look like.
Okay.
And
yeah.
Even on Sunday Night Heat, they used creative camera angles. So Sunday Night Heat at the time was done live from the arena on pay-per-view right. Sundays, and they used creative camera angles to keep you from seeing the chamber. So you actually had to buy the show to see the Elimination Chamber.
Yeah. Which is kind of risky, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, but that's a cool detail. I didn't know that. So kind of getting a little bit of a background of what these guys were all up to. Triple H was World Heavyweight Champion. He had been awarded it by Eric Bischoff after Brock Lesnar defected to SmackDown. He had just a few months beforehand turned heel on Shawn Michaels after Shawn Michaels had and he had teased reforming DX. So he kind of and he'd come back from injury at the beginning of 2002, kind of had the inspirational comeback from injury babyface run that really kind of fell flat, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I agree with that. Yeah,
I would. I think the match with Jericho kind of being upstaged by Hogan and Rock didn't help. And yeah. I mean, there was nowhere to go but downhill from that big ovation. But also every angle that they did around the Triple H and Jericho match just made it seem dumber. Like the dog.
Right. Yeah, the dog. Yeah, I think that's the epic. That would be the bad thing. Well, there were a lot of bad things about it. But and then afterward, it was he and Jericho had a pretty good Hell in the Cell match. But you know, Triple H lost the belt right away to Hogan, kind of taking advantage of the Hogan thing and really rushing him into the title picture. I thought was kind of a mistake. Just like I think if they had built up Hogan, and we don't need to get too detailed into this because we have a lot to talk about. But I think if they had built up Hogan for a couple of months as a contender and then gave him a title shot, I think that would have come off a lot better. But anyway, then Triple H got involved in a feud with The Undertaker that was kind of boring because Undertaker wasn't really all that exciting for the most part in 2002, although the Lesnar match being the big exception to that. So Triple H wasn't exactly having the best 2002. And then after he won was awarded the title, he had feuds with Rob Van Dam, in which I believe Ric Flair turned on Rob Van Dam, and then Ric Flair joined Triple H as his manager, and then that sort of set up Fortune in the early part of 2003.
Evolution.
Oh, I'm sorry, Evolution. Yes, not Fortune. Thank you. and he'd also feuded with Kane in a match that unified the World Heavyweight Championship with the Intercontinental Championship, which had been unified with the European Championship and the Hardcore Championship.
They were really consolidating things at this point. And that Kane feud involved the, you know, one of WWE's worst angles of all time with the Katie Vick situation.
Right. And for those who don't know, Katie Vick was a character who, well, not ever an on-camera character, but basically the way it came up is Kane won a tag title TLC match basically by himself. And at the end of it, he's holding up the belts. Then Triple H comes out and says something like, "I know what you did." And then he uses the words Katie Vick and then you killed her and kind of thing. It's just kind of a cliffhanger for next week. And then it's later revealed that like Kane's like was involved in some sort of car accident in which Katie Vick had been killed. And then the infamous thing of this angle was Triple H humping a fake corpse in a coffin. That is meant to represent Katie Vick.
And he was wearing a Kane mask at the time.
Yes, that's right.
You know, the angle doesn't sound so bad until you get to the Triple H humping a presumed corpse in a coffin. That's, you know, the car accident thing, it seems like wrestling melodrama, but when you get to the coffin sex, there are some issues.
You know, I'm... yes, it was stupid, but the idea that it's like this all-time low in WWE, there's a lot of things WWE that has like insulted my intelligence more than like that than Triple H humping a casket. I mean, it was dumb, it was silly, it was corny, it was bad in a lot of ways, but like, you know, it was, I mean, you know, he was, I mean, if they had actually tried making believe that he was humping a corpse, that would have been bad. That would have been really, really bad. The humping the mannequin is like a way to get heat is not quite as bad to me. It's stupid, but it's more like kind of silly and a little bit laughable to me.
Now I think that the whole fact, it's not exactly the humping the mannequin that gets me. It's the presumed or the assumed necrophilia, like the fact that they're saying that Kane did that. I think that that's the bad part, is that saying that Kane did.
Well, I always kind of assumed that, like, I mean, I don't think that anyone was supposed to believe that he actually did. It was just like the heel being, you know, mean and saying they did, which is bad enough, I guess. But anyway, so it,
needless to say, WWE has not gone back to necrophilia since.
Not that I'm aware of, you know. Unless you count, like, Mae Young. Yeah.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Give it time.
All right. So that was what Triple H was doing. Shawn Michaels had, we kind of mentioned the major thing, but he was injured by Triple H. He had been out of wrestling for, well, he had not had a match in close to 4 years, or actually 4.5 years almost. Mm-hmm. He came back on camera after almost a 2 year absence, actually, and joined up with Kevin Nash and company, and in a kind of the last throes of the NWO. And it basically lasted a couple of weeks or maybe a little bit more, but Kevin Nash ended up injuring his quad, which basically killed the NWO. But the one notable thing that happened was that Booker T joined the NWO for a week, and then Shawn Michaels ended up giving him a super kick and kicking him out. Did I mention that 2002 was kind of a strange year for WWE?
I think so. There were just a lot of stories that it's like they went with them, then they did not go with them, then they went with them, then they... It seemed like they were... This was, again, towards the beginning of the brand split, and they were really trying to figure out what stories they were telling with the new system. And
yeah.
I want to say there was probably a lot of creative turnover and a lot of weird things going on that front.
Yeah. I mean, there was nothing... 2002 had a lot of good stuff too. I mean, you know, and this is obviously among them, and that Shawn Michaels Triple H match at SummerSlam is tremendous. So I mean, there, you know, it certainly was fun, but actually that SummerSlam 2000 show might be my favorite WWE pay per view of all time.
Up there.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much every match in that show is awesome. So, or at least really good. So, Rob Van Dam, as we'd mentioned, you know, had that feud with Triple H. This is kind of ending the period in which I find RVD very useful, and I'm not really a big fan of him even during his good years. But between like 2001 and toward the middle to end of 2002, I think was Rob Van Dam's peak for me as far as my enjoyment of him.
Yeah, I can kind of agree with you on that. I never really was a huge Rob Van Dam fan. I thought he was, you know, that run in 2006, or at least that match against John Cena, I think is always going to hold up as a fun moment and a fun thing to watch. But,
sure.
You know, between 2006 and kind of his run against Triple H, I never thought he was all that relevant. I liked Rob Van Dam and kind of, you know, he did something really interesting in this match, which we'll get to, that, you know, might explain why there was no main event really for him between 2002 and 2006. But I've never been a huge fan of his in-ring style. I think it looks too loose. It looks too fake, to be honest. Like, I'm not one of those guys, you know, I like watching Lucha Libre on occasion, but I think Rob Van Dam, his style just looks too light and ridiculous to me, and I don't enjoy watching him.
Yeah, I don't in general either. And it just Raven did an interview once where he talked about like the reason like he got into wrestling, and it was like, oh, I saw all these flashy moves and I want to do all these flashy moves, and I'm like, that makes a lot of sense. Like,
Yeah.
wrestling to you is doing fancy moves. And that's, ever since then I'm like, okay, well that makes sense. And Rob Van Dam's the kind of thing like I don't mind like 10 to 15 minutes of like once a year. Like that's sort of like what Rob Van Dam is like. I like it's like, okay, it's nice to see you. You can do your thing and then be gone. Like if he showed up in the Royal Rumble every year and did nothing else, like I would be fine with that or something along those lines, But yeah, RVD. Now he and Chris Jericho did have a really good match at King of the Ring 2002, which
Yeah.
leads us into what Chris Jericho was doing. He was the undisputed champion at the beginning of 2002, kind of got that weird push and build with Triple H, had a rematch with him, and then sort of kind of got thrown into the mid card for a while. Interesting that he and Triple H basically spend almost this entire match on the same side and teaming together.
Yeah, especially given their feud in 2002, and it got to Hell in a Cell.
Right. Yeah.
At Judgment Day that year, they were in Hell in a Cell together,
Yeah,
and
this is May.
they
So this is,
spend,
yeah, so 5 months roughly. Yeah.
5 months later, they spend this match almost as a tag team.
Yes, exactly. So that being interesting, and we've pretty much got into what was going on with Kane. I don't even remember what he was doing in the middle of 2002, but I don't think it was anything of tremendous importance. He did prevent the un-Americans from burning an American flag, so that was
Good
pretty
for
cool.
him.
Yeah,
That's, yeah.
he was well. He apparently missed a lot of 2002 with a torn bicep. But before then, he had been feuding with the NWO a little bit because he joined up with a Rock and Hogan for a little while and was I believe the Kane-a-maniac, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think that's what happened. That NWO thing, that was just cursed. Like you. Everyone, it seems like everyone involved got hurt or accidentally turned babyface.
Yes. Yeah, that was sort of just a very strange that was a very strange situation. So yeah, so he came back, did the feud with Triple H, and then feud with Triple H into 2003 and ended up losing his mask. So there was a lot of that going on. And then Booker T, his highlight of 2002 was really the teaming with Goldust. He and Goldust kind of saddled up to him, wanted to be his friend, and then Booker reluctantly agreed. That kind of turned to a good guy at that point, right when basically when Shawn Michaels super kicked him out of the NWO, which was really never followed up on at all, and is of course not relevant to this story because Shawn became a good guy pretty quickly afterwards. So anyway, but Booker was, kind of became a fun-loving guy and teamed with Booker T, and that was really fun. Or teamed with Goldust, and that was a really fun team. I really enjoyed the Booker T Goldust team. In fact, I believe that is Booker T's best tag team of his entire career.
Suck on that, Stevie Ray.
Exactly.
Yeah, I really like that team too. I thought Booker T was in an odd place coming out of 2001 where he came in as WCW champion,
Yeah.
but he never really fit in the main event. I mean, he had an okay match against Rock, but he almost needed Shane, he needed Shane McMahon around him to make him relevant. And so the Booker Dust period was a nice rebuilding time
Yeah.
for him to kind of to really find himself and find the WWE style.
Yeah. And then he had a pretty, well, at least an interesting feud with in 2003 with Triple H. Maybe not the best creative feud, but I like their matches. I think the WrestleMania match that year is actually kind of underrated. And
I
they
think you're crazy.
okay, well, I have been called crazy before. And I like they had a good Raw match a few weeks after that too. So anyway, so that is what everyone in this match was up to. Anything else that you can think of relevant that going on with any of these guys at that time?
I don't think so. I think that you yeah, we covered everything.
Okay, well, good. So we start off with Rob Van Dam against Triple H. Anything notable? I my copy of this didn't have entrances, so I don't know if there's anything in the entrances that should be mentioned.
For one, before the match, we had a video package, and then we had Eric Bischoff come out. And I want to talk about the video package real quick. I honestly think it's one of the best that WWE ever made.
Okay.
It's I don't know why at this time, but you know how WWE is kind of obsessed with Saliva, the band? They used the song Always by Saliva, and I'm not a big Saliva fan, but I really... If you haven't seen the video package for this match, try and find a copy with the video package on it because it's well worth checking out. So that I just wanted to put out there. We had Eric Bischoff come out and explain the rules again because, you know, this is the first time this match has happened.
Right.
And we also had Saliva playing the King of My World song for Chris Jericho as he came to the ring.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. They were at the World in New York City, the former WWEF New York.
Yes.
And they were playing, I guess, a simulcast in with the sound system in the arena and played Jericho to the ring.
Huh.
Also, it's in Madison Square Garden, which is always worth highlighting because they use the short entryway in there.
Yeah. I always liked the short entryway. That was always a nice thing about Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, especially when they put the little screens up there.
Yeah,
on the backdrop, like at WrestleMania 20, and kind of just that was it. That's how they decorated, or that was the stage set up for the show. Is just here's the screen. You're good.
Indeed.
Should we wait to talk about the Shawn Michaels attire?
Well, go ahead and talk about it now.
Yeah, Shawn Michaels looked like crap. No, literally, his tights were brown.
Yes,
In his book, he basically says he had no intention of wrestling again, maybe till WrestleMania. He was, you know, so he went home after SummerSlam 2002 when when he beat Triple H and then Triple H hit him with the sledgehammer. He chopped his hair off to like a pixie cut.
Yeah.
And just, you know, started putting on some weight. I mean, he didn't look fat or anything. He's still Shawn Michaels, my God. But, you know, started not being in ring shape and eating cookies with his son. And then he got the call to come into Survivor Series and said, yeah, I can do it, but it's not going to be pretty. And this was compounded by the fact that the WWE seamstress, I guess, was feeling really creative. And they said, I'm going to make some new tights for Shawn Michaels. I'm going to redesign the classic Heartbreak Kid tights. And came up with this brown monstrosity. Hmm. And they were unfinished. They had big white letters of HBK across the rump area. And also this weird, it wasn't the standard heartbreak symbol. It was kind of weird and it barely looked like a heart breaking.
Right.
But that was all of the ornateness of the tights. And then he just wore cowboy boots with them.
Oh, okay.
He looked, I don't think Shawn Michaels has ever looked worse in a match.
No. Yeah, his outfits are usually pretty good. I mean, not like the early to mid 90s ones are pretty gaudy, but that was sort of the style then. But yeah, they're strange. They're very, it's very dark. They're very, you know, obviously it was good that, you know, that they were abandoned after this, but yeah, very, very strange. I didn't know the backstory, so I'm glad you told me about that. I had not heard that before. So
I know a lot of Shawn Michaels trivia.
Well, good. then you're a good man for this podcast. Everyone else pretty much looks normal. Jericho's a ponytail, which he kind of was doing during this period. So I'm not usually a fan of guys wrestling in ponytails, but you know, whatever. I guess it gets their hair out of their face. So
yeah,
makes sense. So we start off with Rob Van Dam against Triple H. Are the our two competitors. We have Triple H is backdropped onto the steel ramp pretty quickly, which happens a lot in this match. There's a lot of backdropping onto the steel ramp, particularly Shawn Michaels. Really pretty much dominated for the first 5 minutes by Rob Van Dam. Like, I cannot recall a 5-minute sequence of Triple H being beaten up more thoroughly or maybe more consistently, you know, throughout the entire time than during this 5-minute sequence.
Yeah, especially in this period of time when, you know, the general consensus with most people is that Triple H wasn't putting anyone over, that he wasn't, you know, that Triple H was being kind of a jerk right. The whole time.
Yeah.
It's funny to watch this and, man, he got the crap kicked out of him.
Right, yeah. I mean, he's tossed into the cage like 5 or 6 times. One of the most violent, I've never seen Rob Van Dam be so violent, which is weird because he spent so much time in ECW. But like, I never really think of like Rob Van Dam as a guy who was violent to another person. You know, he did always like funny moves, but really RVD's kind of a chillax guy, you know.
So, I might have liked a more violent RVD.
Maybe.
Yeah.
He monkey flips Triple H onto the stage, does sort of a silly rolling thunder where he sort of does it and then he hops over the ropes and lands it. Triple H bleeds pretty quickly. Then RVD goes under the top of Jericho's pod, which Jericho is smart and grabs the leg. Triple H tries to take advantage, but then ends up getting crotched in the ropes. And then RVD comes off the top, sort of lands on his hip and grazes Triple H. Then Triple H is sent into the cage and staggers back into the ring. And then the 5 minutes is up, and then we have Jericho come in.
Yep, I really like that RVD being pulled through the chain spot. I thought that was something unique, and
yeah,
it was really a cool way to I thought that this match, out of all the Elimination Chamber matches we've seen, this is one of the ones that uses the cell the best and the most. They really make sure to use every trick with the pods and pulling people through, using the chains and the outside as much as possible.
Okay, I have a question. Has every Elimination Chamber match had a full 5-minute round every single time, or have they gone to shorter rounds since then?
Nope. It's always kayfabe 5 minutes.
Okay.
I think that's what, you know, I think this one was closer to a real 5 minutes, but I think they always say it's 5.
Okay.
But you know how things go with the Royal Rumble and everything else.
It's... Yeah. But I just meant, like, it seems like some of the other Elimination Chamber matches are shorter than this one. Because this one's very long. It's like 42 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
So.
They go a while after
that's true.
Shawn Michaels' release, though.
That's true. So, I mean, I guess it's 20 minutes, or it's 20, let's see, 5 with a 2, then 5. So
20.
It's 20. Or I need to do math.
It's 20 minutes until everyone is out.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right. That makes sense. Okay. 20 minutes. Anyway, we're going to edit that out because me being dumb about math is not something people need to hear about. So anyway, Jericho's in. And then, yeah, we get the really sort of odd Triple H and Jericho teaming for about most of the 5 minutes. RVD makes a decent account of himself for a while, gets a spinning heel kick and then a standing moonsault, gets 2, tries a splash onto Jericho. Then, and this was cool. Yeah. He jumps from the ropes, tries to splash Jericho, but then Jericho moves, so he sort of hops onto the cage like Spider-Man and then turns around and then does a splash from the other side. That was really nice use of athleticism. That was really cool.
Nice use of athleticism. And remember, I mean, I feel like now, again, with getting 2 Elimination Chamber matches on the same show every year, we're almost spoiled in that we expect spots like these. But when you're watching this show for the first time and it's the first Elimination Chamber and you have no idea what to expect from the match, and you ordered it on blind faith, it's a pretty neat thing once you actually see it in action.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really, I mean, if you think about how important it is to establish these matches, I mean, this match and Hell in the Cell, I mean, the fact that the first instance of those matches were such classic, you know, incredible matches, you know, memorable for, you know, pretty much everything throughout. And I mean, what would have happened if the first Hell in the Cell had been terrible, or this had been really boring? I mean, I don't think we'd ever see another one again.
Yeah, look at the WWE Championship Scramble from Unforgiven 2008.
Right,
still hasn't come back.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I guess you never know what concepts are going to work or what aren't going to work. But I mean, you know, maybe if they tweak the scramble, it could have, you know, it could be really good. You know, you just don't know because the first time it failed and they never tried it again.
Yeah, I like the scramble concept, by the way. I thought it was kind of a fun one.
Yeah, I thought maybe having three in one show was kind of not great, but yeah, I don't have a problem with the idea. I think it maybe need to be tweaked a bit, but maybe if we do the Scramble podcast at some point, we will get into what that needed or what that didn't need. So we have RVD does that spot, and then Triple H is able to recover a little bit and hits his clothesline, and then I think he tries to like pose, like do kind of like his flex thing, but then stumbles backwards because of like being woozy from the blood. I'm not sure. I hope that's what he was trying to do, because if that's what he was trying to do, it would have been awesome.
Yeah. Let's just assume that it was.
Fair enough.
Way to go, Triple H.
Yes. Yay. So we have Jericho, works over RVD, does a back suplex, and does one of my favorite Jericho-isms, the, come on baby pin, where he yells, come on baby, he flexes, and then he stands on with his foot on top of the guy. RVD then fights them off for a little bit, but then runs into the high knee by, Triple H, and then Jericho immediately following with a senton splash. And then this is where they really do the double teaming, with Jericho holding RVD, Triple H punching them, and slamming him both back, first into the cage. So this basically the rest of it is Triple H and, Jericho, teaming, including, Triple H actually trying to whip, Jericho into RVD, but then RVD avoiding it, fighting them off for a bit, and then running into a DDT.
Yeah, and at this point, it kind of felt like the heels with the advantage in War Games.
Right. Although,
like it.
Yeah, go ahead.
It definitely seemed, you know, both Triple H and Chris Jericho were heels, and they had their moments of slight conflict with each other, but it really had kind of that feel to it where they, much like in War Games, they outnumbered the babyface, and then were five minutes later, had another babyface coming in to make the save and to get the crowd back into it. So This was a heat building 5 minutes.
Exactly. Yes. And then Booker T comes in and very much does that. And of course they're the only two heels in the match. The heels are outnumbered. Mm. So sort of interesting.
It's weird.
Yeah. They were sort of able to avoid that though. Pretty well. I mean, I thought the way they structured the match, there was really not any really, like, awkwardness is like, oh, the heels are outnumbered here. And I guess it being an every man for himself type match, that's fine. I mean, it wouldn't have been a huge problem anyway, but they were able to make it so that that wasn't an issue.
Yeah, but it definitely goes against the logic of normal multi-man matches where,
sure,
you know, it's a baby face trying to overcome all of these heels. And I mean, if you look at the structure of Raw at the time, they just didn't have the heels to fill it out. Triple H was the heel, and this was him against, you know, three of his last babyface challengers.
Sure. Booker T cleans house. JR has an interesting line saying that no one deserves to be world champion more than Booker T, which I don't know where that exactly came from. I guess, you know, we're leading into Booker being a contender, so maybe it's just you know, a little throwaway because, you know, they're building him for that. But I just found that an interesting thing for Jim Ross to say.
Yeah, it was definitely different. I think maybe they knew where they were going at WrestleMania or where they had planned to go at WrestleMania, so this was the planting of that seed.
Right, exactly. So Booker, like immediately following that statement, Booker does a spin-a-rooney after he cleans house. Then he and RVD, fight for a little bit. They run into each other's heel kicks, and Booker gets a leg lariat for two. Triple H gets involved, but then gets scissors kicked. Jericho and RVD then sort of go after each other, and then RVD ends up at the top of the pod and goes for a frog splash on Triple H. Grabs his knee as if he's hurt it, and it seems like he may have really hurt it because pretty quickly Booker T gets a missile drop kick on RVD and eliminates him.
And
So
that's not even the worst injury that came from that spot.
it was tri was that where Triple H was hurt and had the issues he had
Crushed
in
trachea, I
2003?
think. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He landed with his leg across Triple H's throat, and from this point in the match, you'll notice Triple H is pretty uninvolved until it gets down to Triple H and Michaels.
Okay,
He
yeah.
kind of tries his best to stay out of the way because he gets his trachea crushed, and he can barely breathe, let alone talk or anything else for the rest of the match.
Wow. Well,
That's what I was talking about when I mentioned Rob Van Dam not getting a push.
I recall that now. I'd completely forgotten that that was the case, but I recall that that was that now that you mentioned it. Yeah, that's right. Wow, that's I mean, you know, he wasn't in. Yeah, I mean, he was obviously off to the side quite a bit. I kind of figured he was just selling being the first guy, you know, in the match for a lot of it. But that's, I mean, you say one thing about Triple, you know, you can say what you want about Triple H, but one thing, I mean, you know, he will work a match through injuries. There's no question about that.
He could have easily been. This is one of my favorite Triple H matches. I think because he did something extremely stupid, but he didn't die doing it, so it's chill.
Right.
He could have easily, Booker then pinned RVD right after that spot. Booker came over to get the near fall on Triple H. Triple H could have easily whispered to Booker, "I'm getting out of this thing.
Yeah.
Something's wrong. I'm done." And he stayed in the match. And he didn't even just say, "Okay, Shawn Michaels is going to come in, super kick me, one, two, three, I'm done.
Sure.
And then you guys can finish the match however you want."
Yeah.
He stayed until the very end
Yeah, I
and
mean,
wrestled a long sequence with Michaels at the end as well.
oh yeah, absolutely, and a really great sequence. I mean, there was
Yeah.
nothing that noticed as far as timing wise or anything that would have indicated that he was hurt. I mean, that's really an impressive professional job, even though yeah you you wonder about safety of that, but obviously he made it through it. So anyway. Then we have, as you mentioned, the near falls there. Jericho misses a lion salt on Booker, runs into a spine buster and gets a two. And then we have the 5 minute time period expiring again. So now we have Kane coming in, who goes after Jericho and Booker while Triple H is off to the side. As I wrote it, while Triple H bleeds.
Do you want some trivia for this one too?
I would love some trivia for this one.
Oh, I've got some trivia for you.
Yes.
Kane was not supposed to enter right there. Shawn Michaels said in his book, basically, this match is like everything that can go bad will, but this match is so good that it doesn't matter. That ev the lights focused on the wrong pod.
Ah.
And so Kane had to enter the match. A spot early. That was supposed to be Shawn Michaels coming in.
Okay.
And you see when you watch it, Kane, he doesn't rush out of his pod the way the other guys do. Kane looks around and is like, "You're kidding. What?" And is kind of asking. And then they show a shot and you see Shawn Michaels talking to the referees behind him, like, "The hell's going on, guys?" So that's a that, you know, that's another unique one for you as this match goes on. Just you've got Shawn Michaels looks bad. Kane is in there before he's supposed to be. Triple H is hurt. What else could go wrong in this match?
Yeah, well,
Nothing,
yeah.
actually.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
So he goes after Jericho and Booker, tosses Jericho, basically javelins him into the cage, and then tosses him through the pod, which gets a huge reaction. That's the first time that anyone's crashed through the pod.
That
Then
was
he works
bullet
over Triple H,
plexiglass.
yeah, through the plexiglass in the pod, which is bulletproof, but not
Yeah.
Jericho proof. So, Then works over Triple H in the corner. Meanwhile, we have Booker being low-blowed by Jericho and then chokeslammed by Kane. And then Jericho follows with a lion salt to pin Booker. So a lot of a lot of finishers. There were a number of sequences where guys would be hit by multiple finishers and be beaten. So, you know, you going back to the timing being off with Michaels not, you know, coming in last, it did seem strange to me that Michaels was last, like that would, they would have him, you know, be wrestle the least amount. That's just sort of a weird thing for him to be the least amount and Hunter to be the most amount of, you know, I guess that was kind of a reason for them to have a rematch with Hunter, you know, lasting the longest in the cage. But yeah, that's you know, explains that now.
Yeah, it's odd. You think Michaels was kind of the babyface underdog coming in, you know, JR said multiple times in his entrance and in the match, do you believe? And it was right. About Michaels.
Yeah, he believes in himself, yeah.
Yeah, and asking the fans if they believed. And so it was weird to have Michaels not as the guy in the match. Not, you know, not the guy almost, not in first, because I think there was still some doubt to Michaels' ability to work for that long and to take all of those bumps on the steel, although he does take quite a few.
Took a lot.
But yeah. It was odd. It was odd to have him in absolutely last when you think that, you know, I think that suits a guy like Kane better. You've got the monster who obviously has the advantage because of that. And then, well, he's in last too. And, you know, you can have the King sitting there going, my money's on Kane.
Yeah.
Because the King apparently loses every time he goes to Vegas to bet on wrestling.
Yes, exactly. we have Jericho and Kane fighting on the ramp. Jericho tries to climb away, but that does not work as you might expect. Kane works him over and press slams him into the ring. Then, and Kane has his working boots on because he does some knee lifts. He does a suplex on Jericho for two. He's pretty spry here, you know, for Kane.
Yeah, he was impressive in this one. And I didn't remember until I was watching it for this podcast, just because my opinion of Kane is rather low at the moment. I didn't remember just how good Kane can be.
Yeah, he was really, I mean, he was like not quite as muscular as he kind of went through a period starting around 99 and going in through, you know, 02-03 where he dropped some weight and was able to sort of do quite a bit more, you know, just had more energy and, you know, was kind of able to come up top a little more and, you know, and bounce around a little more. It was kind of nice to see. Then he kind of got a little, you know, just bigger and chunkier, you know, as he got older and such. And, you know, I don't know. I'm fine with Kane. I don't really like seeing him that much. I mean, in small doses, I'm fine with Kane. But yeah, he definitely, you know, had that youth, or he was definitely younger and much more spry at this point.
Yeah. I don't dislike Kane. I really dislike the matches he's had with John Cena this year. They have not been all that great at all. But I'm not appreciating even where he's going at the moment. But I do appreciate some Kane on occasion, and this is definitely one of those occasions.
Sure. So Kane slams Hunter off the top rope. He tries to choke slam Jericho, but Jericho gets a low blow, and then his drop kicked off the top. And then 5 minutes has passed, and we have Shawn Michaels in. He fights off.
Who wiggled before his entrance. He was doing a weird, like, dance. You know, Shawn Michaels, I think, was still trying to find his new character.
Yeah.
He came back with the, you know, the Hulk with the NWO, and then he became kind of the comeback kid. He, at SummerSlam 2002, he wore a shirt that said Philippians 4:13, which is, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And so he had this whole, you know, the Christian gimmick going. Sure. But I still, he wasn't quite into the mannerisms that he would start doing with that, with, you know, the pose on the knees and all that. So he was still wiggling and dancing a little more than we would see Shawn Michaels do
right
in the last 8 years of his career.
Yeah. So it's interesting how the different facets of Michaels' personality kind of came out in those 8 years too, you know, and he's obviously a complicated guy, you know, mm-hmm. and, Yeah, I've talked about it before about, you know, like some of, like, you know, kind of the angry stuff he did that, you know, with Hulk Hogan and kind of just a lot of the different, you know, facets of his personality, how malleable he was during that time. And I think we should talk a little bit about the end as far as that, you know, where he, you know, the end is he wins the title and, but wasn't, you know, it's a quick reign and was never, even though he was in a lot of title feuds, he never won it back again. And kind of how interesting that that sort of is, that he was always kind of the contender after this point, but he was never really, you know, other than this brief reign, was never, you know, the guy. You know, he was always, you know, trying to be the guy.
That was a bummer. I mean, I mentioned before, I'm a big Shawn Michaels fan. He is my favorite wrestler of all time. And I mean, you know, for me personally, seeing him win the title here was awesome. Mm-hmm. But then you turn around and he never, you know, he lost it a month later in a Three Stages of Hell match at Armageddon 2002.
Yeah, and which wasn't really the best match. And
you know. No, it wasn't. Especially not the best that Michaels and Triple H would go on to have. They'd go on to have much better matches in 2003 and 2004.
Sure.
But they, it was strange. I mean, there were so many moments where it looked like Michaels was going to be the guy. I think you think about 2007 against John Cena, and he challenged him at WrestleMania, and I thought he was going to win it at Mania that year. And then again, he had that 1 hour match with him on Raw that wasn't for the title that he ended up winning.
Right.
But I thought that that would naturally lead to them having a rematch for the title, possibly in an Iron Man setting, you know. And then you had that 2007 feud as well with Randy Orton, where it looked like Michaels could be the guy to stop the Age of Orton. And this was before Michaels, while he was the Elder Statesman, before he really took on that mantle like he did in the last couple years of his career, where he was above the world title picture.
Right.
So, I find it odd that he never won the title back after this, not even for like a thank you, nice work reign that some guys seem to get.
Yeah, well, you know, he was getting those WrestleMania moments, so there, I guess they were showing the appreciation in other ways, and obviously he delivered those moments, but it's interesting because of how much the title mattered to Shawn Michaels, like in 96 and 97, clearly. I mean, and obviously that was a lot of the foundation between the problems between him and Bret Hart, and so for him not to hold it in the 2000s, I guess that became less important to him as, you know, he gained other priorities in his life, his religion, obviously, his family, you know, that kind of thing. So
it's worth noting, too, that for most of that last run, he didn't work a full house show schedule.
That's true.
He worked a modified house show schedule at most, and for a really long part of that run, worked the, you know, Mondays for TV, and works the occasional Sunday pay-per-view, but beyond that did not really work much. And I think that's one of the reasons that that run was as long as it was. Sure. And also, you know, it kind of, Michaels would also take 3 or 4 months off at a time to heal up or to hang out with his family. He took a summer break. He took a lot of time off.
Yeah. Particularly the last 3 or 4 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So not the guy you're going to put the title on at that point.
True. True. Yeah. So anyway, back to the match. We have Michaels, he's clotheslined by Kane, but then he immediately follows with a big flying forearm. Michaels is tossed into the turnbuckle, and then we get the famous flip bump that he takes in the turnbuckle. Kane sort of goes crazy. He does like a double choke slam on Jericho, then traditional choke slams on Michaels and Triple H, followed by another big choke slam on Jericho. Does the throat?
And Triple H barely gets up in the air for that one.
Yeah,
that's I thought that was noticeable, and again, a place where you can see if you know it, the Triple H is injured, because he doesn't. Triple H doesn't really get up there and doesn't take the bump as he normally would for a choke slam.
Mm-hmm. And then the throat slash, and he picks up Triple H, teases the tombstone, but then runs into a Michael super kick. He does the zombie sit up, but then Triple H gets the pedigree, and then Jericho gets the lion salt to steal the pin. So that was kind of a nice sequence of finishers to get Kane out of there. but still protected because he took three finishes. You know, who's going to be able to kick out of that? Maybe John Cena, and, you know, but.
And Ultimate Warrior, but.
Right. Well, yes.
And this also, I thought it was kind of cool. Jericho has now pinned two wrestlers with the Lion Salt.
Right, which how many times did he pin somebody with Lion Salt? I mean, that's like...
It wasn't often.
Right, that's like two out of like maybe 10 times in, you know, his WWE time where he would have done that.
Yeah.
Never was a big fan of Lion Salt. Always kind of looked a little bit like, a little too light.
It's a transition move to me. It's not a, you know, a signature transition, something that you do when the crowd gets into it, but I don't think it's a finish.
Exactly, yes. Right. So, we have one of several sequences of Sean being clotheslined over the ropes into the ramp and being landed hard into the cage, landing on his back. Jim Ross makes mention of the fact that this is the first Survivor Series for Michaels, and in fact only the second match at all since the Montreal Survivor Series of 1997. And then we have another big long sequence of Jericho and Triple H working over Shawn, but both really trying to bust him up, like punching him in the forehead. In fact, Jericho screams, "Bleed, you son of a bitch!" And and Jericho does a lot of like yelling during this match. A number of like, you know, like things. Jericho's doing some nice heel work, I think, throughout this entire time. Does a little bit of dancing, and then Triple H takes his turn by raking Sean's face into the cage. They both trade punches on him, and then finally Sean starts bleeding, and Jericho goes intensely after the cut.
Can I just mention how much I love the Jericho shuffle? That little dance that he does? That thing
yes.
is... I do that when I celebrate things to this day. Okay. I do a little dance, Chris Jericho shuffle style. So that's okay. Definitely one of my favorites.
Good. The Jericho shuffle. I like it. You know, it's not quite the Super Bowl shuffle, but it's, you know, in the list of shuffles, I think it belongs maybe top five for sure.
Yeah, it's not the undisputed champion of shuffles, but yeah. It's up there.
Yeah. Now, is it ahead of the Icky shuffle or behind the Icky shuffle? That's the question.
I think it's ahead.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. That might be a controversial statement, but we'll just go ahead and let it go. So Sean finally blocks the throw into the cage. He slams Jericho into it. He clotheslines Triple H over the ropes, teases a pile driver on Jericho on the metal, but Jericho backdrops it. In the ring, we have Sean and Triple H fighting. Sean gets the flying forearm and a kip up. Jericho then sneaks in and gets a bulldog and a Lion Salt, but the Lion Salt only gets two counts. But Jericho is so aghast at this that he tries another pin attempt, but only another second two count. So,
I thought that was nicely built up. Like I said before, Jericho put two guys out with the Lion Salt, and he went to put Sean out, and Sean got to kick out of it.
Exactly. Yes, that was excellent. I like that as well. Sean ends up getting to the top, getting the moonsault for two. The ref is just a bit late to cover. I think it's Earl Hebner. It's a little bit late on the pin. Then Michaels locks in the walls of Jericho, Boston Crab. Triple H breaks it up with a DDT. Now, Jericho tries a cover, and then Triple H pulls him off, which is a little bit of a strange timing thing because he seemed fine with Jericho pinning other guys. And, in fact, I think he went for some near falls on Sean. But, anyway, he doesn't care for it here. Jericho slaps it, and then they trade blows.
Yeah, it was that weird, I want to finish him thing, and it's like, dude, you could have gotten rid of that guy.
Yeah, but, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of get it within the context of the larger Shawn Michaels Triple H feud, but it seems like he was kind of okay with it like just a few minutes before. So, you know, I get him being fine with it for the other guys and not being as fine with it with Shawn, but yeah, it just didn't make sense in that immediate moment.
Yeah, it was a little bit odd. I mean, but it's what, you know, it's kind of just what heels do in matches like these. I feel like they disintegrate and, you know,
yeah,
throw them out.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's a very, very tiny thing. So
yeah,
we'll look past it. So then finally, so Jericho slaps him. I think he says, screams something like, "What the hell are you doing? I could have pinned him."
Yeah.
They trade blows. Triple H clotheslines him down, then he gets a face buster off the ropes. Jericho does a weird kind of come off the top thing, then which he basically gets kicked in the stomach, and Triple H teases the pedigree, but then Jericho locks in the walls of Jericho, holds under for quite a while. Triple H drags himself close to the ropes, but then Jericho pulls it back, and then Michaels out of nowhere hits the sweet chin music and Pete and pins Jericho. But that was a pretty cool. I've seen Michaels do that before on submissions, but it always works really well. Always really nicely done. Camera, that was good there too.
Yeah, because you didn't obviously see Shawn Michaels getting up, so it came in as a surprise, which was great.
Yeah.
Do you know, are there rope breaks in the Elimination Chamber?
That's a good question. There's no disqualification, was there disqualification?
I don't think so. No one's been disqualified from the chamber, I don't think. I mean, it's hard to get some weapons in. I think Triple H has had the sledgehammer in there, and there was that awful Extreme Elimination Chamber match in 2006.
Right.
But I want to say it's anything goes. Oh, Eric Bischoff said in his promo before the match, the only way you can lose is pinfall, or if you can't take it and you submit.
Oh, okay. All right, well, there you go. Yeah. So, well, maybe he could have used the ropes for leverage to be able to,
break the hold.
Maybe, yeah. Mm. We'll never know. So we're about 30 minutes in at this point, and so we have another 10 minutes of just Shawn and Triple H going after each other. They trade punches in the middle of the ring. Triple H gets a spine buster for two. Then he's able to work Shawn over for a while, gets backdropped again hard in the steel. And then Shawn is able to reverse a whip into the cage. He teases the pedigree onto the steel floor, but Triple H catapults him into the pod. Works him over in the ring for a few minutes. There's a cool part where Shawn is bleeding. He's struggling to pull himself off up on Triple H's tights. Hunter tries to punch him down, but then Shawn fights back, wins the slugfest. It's just kind of a nice, like, comeback moment. But then Hunter cuts him off with a face buster and clotheslines him over the ropes onto the steel once again.
Yeah, the pulling himself up kind of, it reminded me of the WrestleMania 26 match where Shawn's last match where he was pulling himself up on Undertaker's tights. And I thought, as I'm watching it, I was like, oh, hey, he had done that before. Look at that.
Yeah, yeah. That's always just the way that he did it was really, cool. The great things I think that Shawn was able to do, he was obviously one of the greats of all time, but he understood how to evoke sympathy at the right times. And it's weird because of that contrasted with a personality that I've always kind of found pretty obnoxious. Not as much in his later years, but for a long time, there's sort of that interesting dichotomy is where he can be this obnoxious guy, but also able to get the sympathy of the crowd in the right moments.
Yeah, it's definitely an odd dichotomy there because I think it's one of the reasons why people still like Shawn Michaels, even though he was pretty obnoxious, especially, between like 1995 and 1998, or yeah, really 1995 and 2001.
Right.
He was an obnoxious dude, but when you saw him in the ring, there was something there. There was both a spark of life and just this thing that you related to with him in a match.
Yeah. I'll be honest. The obnoxiousness for Shawn Michaels for me made me not like him for a long time. His great matches, I recognized how great they were. I appreciated him as a performer, but it wasn't really until the mid-2000s where I kind of got to the point where I really liked him a lot more than I did beforehand, I guess. So it's funny because you were in the point where when he won the title, you were really excited. When he won the title, I'm just kind of like, ugh, I don't know, Shawn Michaels again, I wasn't that excited about that. It kind of slowly turned around in the next year, but it was really I think 2005 with the Hogan feud where I was finally like, okay, I'm cool with the Shawn Michaels thing. I'm willing to go with it. That's fine.
So it's when he started being obnoxious again.
Well, yeah, I think when he was just so over the top with it and so like amusing and so like almost making fun of himself a little bit, I think that helped. But anyway, so and I also think that the Shawn Michaels Triple H feud for me, they obviously had some incredibly great matches, but they also had a few that were not so great as well. So it was kind of always a hit or miss thing with me with them. And I kind of got sick of that feud a little bit too. So there were definitely some up and down points with me and Shawn Michaels and, you know, throughout the years. But obviously, no question, one of the greats of all time. So back to the match. We have Hunter trying a pedigree on the steel, but he's catapulted into the cage. Shawn follows with a clothesline back in the ring. He goes to the top and then goes on top of the pod and hits the elbow drop. And Hunter's condition with the throat, that elbow drop, being able to hit that in a way, you know, in which, you know, you're not really hurting your opponent to, you know, who has a throat problem, is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I wrote in my notes on the match, Shawn Michaels' elbow from the top of the pod. Why would Triple H allow this? Like,
yes,
you'd think he would call an audible and be like, no dice, no one's jumping on me from the top of a pod ever again.
Right.
I mean, maybe he didn't have the voice to call an audible, but you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely something, you know, it shows the trust that those two have between each other and just the care that Shawn Michaels can take of someone in the ring.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just you marvel at the ability to just be able to jump off a pod and land on somebody without hurting them. But especially when they're in that condition and just the timing and just, you know, professional wrestlers are pretty incredible human beings, at least being able to wrestle professionally when you're great at it. You know, it's pretty remarkable, just the physical and mental and all the strength and, you know, intelligence and everything that goes into it. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's professional wrestlers are the reason that we're wrestling fans. They are really incredible performers. And these,
exactly.
I know some people have their stuff against Triple H, and I don't, you know, I'm not saying Triple H is the best of all time, but Triple H is a great performer. Shawn Michaels is a great performer. Absolutely. And I think that what these guys did with these last 10 minutes is a great display of that.
Oh, no question about it. So Shawn sort of teases a slow cover, but instead he stands up and tunes up the band for the sweet chin music. He goes for that, but then Triple H catches it. He hits the pedigree, but he's slow to cover. He gets one arm across, but then it's a kick out. At this point, Hunter gets into the ref's face. Then he goes for the pedigree again, but then Michaels does a back body drop. Now, just the timing of this is just incredible. Shawn goes in the corner. He starts his motion. Hunter turns around right at the exact time, gets the boot right to the face, and then Michaels covers him, and then he's the champion. I mean,
it's beautiful.
Yeah, we see this kind of thing all the time, but just the amount of talent in, you know, and just the timing that you have to get that all in one perfect motion is just incredible.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that you go, you know, probably half the time you're going to get that perfect and half the time it's going to look a little off but still be cool. And this time it was absolutely on the dot, not a second too soon, not a second too late.
Right, exactly. So, and that's it. And then we get, you know, a huge confetti celebration. Michaels has the belt, you know, kind of weird to see him with the big gold belt. Obviously only had it for a very short time. He had a couple of, I believe he defended it against Rob Van Dam on TV, which I think was his only defense other than the, at least TV defense, until he lost to Triple H.
I think so.
Yeah, they did, because at the end of it, I think Hunter comes out and attacks them both, and then does like a side slam on Sean on a chair and hurts his back.
Yeah.
I have a distinct memory of that.
Then that totally happened. But yeah, he would hold the title for a month. It was kind of disappointing.
Yeah.
You know, obviously they had a place that they wanted to go for WrestleMania season, and
yeah,
Shawn Michaels was not the champion for that.
Right, and really what Shawn Michaels ended up doing was better than him being in the championship picture, was that really that great feud with Jericho that kind of cemented his comeback and, mm-hmm. you know, and really brought him back, you know, full-time, at least relatively speaking. So
yeah, and Michaels, he didn't plan to be at WrestleMania that year. There, which is odd watching this match, considering the amount of time that he spends with Jericho.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the beginning of their feud.
Exactly, but yeah.
There wasn't a concrete plan at this point for him to be at WrestleMania. I think the idea was always put the belt on him for a month, give people a short reprieve from Triple H, and then go into Mania with Triple H as champion and Booker T as challenger.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and it's interesting how all the guys kind of interweave in this match, as far as like Rob Van Dam was like, you know, teamed with Kane, with Booker T. We have the epic Triple H Michaels feuds. We have the epic. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these guys kind of did stuff with each other, either as teams or as, you know, as feuds throughout their career. And I guess if all these guys had pretty long careers in WWE and had long careers in wrestling, so that kind of makes sense. But yeah, I mean, all six of these guys pretty much stood the test of time in WWE, which, you know, it's I'm sure there's other Elimination Chamber matches where there's guys that are in there. It's like, oh, wow, they pushed this guy really that strongly this time. Like Chris Masters and Carlito are in one of the Elimination Chamber, you know, guys. Now, I love Carlito, and Chris Masters got really good later, but that's sort of, you know, those guys obviously, you know, did not have the longevity. I mean, you could make a WWE Hall of Fame case for all six of these guys. I bet all six of them, maybe not Van Damme, unless he comes back into the fold, but everyone else is probably going to be a WWE Hall of Famer. Shawn Michaels obviously already is. So,
yeah, it's definitely a who's who in this match, and I think it's a testament to all six guys that I honestly believe that up until this past year, there's not been a better Elimination Chamber match than this one.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I haven't seen all of them, so, mm-hmm. You know.
I think I have.
Yeah,
that makes me sad.
I have them all, and obviously most of them are main events, so I'll probably end up watching all of them even the ones I have not seen. But this is a tremendous match. I really, really enjoyed it. This is the first time I'd seen it. So
oh wow,
yeah. So I feel like I'd seen like highlights of it before, but because I remember the finish, but I didn't remember like anything else of it. So. So yeah, it's really great stuff. Definitely an essential, I would say.
Oh yeah,
definitely something that everyone should check out.
As you're getting ready for Elimination Chamber this year, check this one out. It's going to be well worth your time. And in case you're wondering which match I think was the better Elimination Chamber than this one, and it's pretty darn close.
Yeah,
I would say the SmackDown Elimination Chamber from Elimination Chamber 2011.
Right.
For the first time, they top the final two sequence,
yes,
that was in this one with Edge and Rey Mysterio. And it,
absolutely,
was just another brilliant 10-minute sequence that has to be seen.
Right, yeah. And Drew McIntyre is awesome in that match.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he played a nice role as well. I think they came close. I remember, I want to say it was 2009, the SmackDown Elimination Chamber. They did a big surprise with Edge and Jeff Hardy starting it out and Edge getting pinned.
Right.
As the defending champion, Edge was pinned within 2 minutes of the top of the match.
Yeah, and didn't he beat up Kofi Kingston and sneak into the Raw one later and win the Raw one? Isn't that what happened?
Yep, he turned the WWE Championship to the World Heavyweight Championship in one night.
That crafty Edge.
I hear he's an opportunist.
Perhaps.
What did you think about the fact that in 2002, they put the belt on both Hulk Hogan and Shawn Michaels in the same year?
I thought it was kind of strange. it certainly, it's weird how between 2001 and really until the summer of 2004, all the different ways that WWE tries to make money off of WCW.
Yeah.
Because you have, of course, the invasion year. You have the NWO coming in. Then 2003 is basically Triple H feuding with the mainly WCW guys. I mean, you have Booker T, you have Kevin Nash, you have Goldberg, obviously being the big one.
Steiner.
Oh, yeah, Scott Steiner, yeah, that as well, yeah. And then 2004, they go with Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit's champions, you know, so, and obviously who, you know, made their mark in WCW. So it wasn't until really, you know, they went with Orton and then with Batista and Cena where they decide, okay, we're done with this WCW thing. Now we're going to go with the guys that we've been in our development system for a while and try to build some new stars. Which kind of moved them out of that era.
That's really interesting. I had never looked at it in a every year. It's like they were not rehashing, but they were trying to use WCW in some way. And that's an interesting way to look at things, really.
Yeah. And they never really used ECW until the One Night Stand. I mean, I guess Van Damme would be the only guy they really ever took. Used seriously, you know, who was an ECW guy. I mean, I know, you know, a couple of the guys had runs in ECW, but as far as being like most of his or was really defined as an ECW guy pre-WWE, I think Van Damme is really the only one that I can think of who, you know, was any kind of big deal.
Yeah, and a guy WWE. Whose gimmick stayed the same all the way through from what he was in ECW to WWE to now in TNA. Van Damme has failed to evolve for 13, 14 years.
Yeah, and Van Damme was a big deal in WWE that first year, like 2001, when he debuted. I mean, he was hot. Like, people were really into him. I mean, they had an opportunity to kind of capitalize and kind of get behind him, and they kind of failed to do that. And maybe there were good reasons for not doing that. But he really felt like a guy who could have been more special than he was if they had gotten behind him. And I'm not saying they should have, because I'm not a huge RVD fan, but that was kind of one of those, like, people that at the time people complained about, like, hitting the glass ceiling kind of thing. And a lot of, you know, there was that with, you know, Benoit and Jericho and Booker T and a number of other guys who, you know, who were kind of behind the Triple H's of the world, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, Van Damme. During that period. In 2001, he had main evented a pay per view with Steve Austin and Kurt Angle.
Right, exactly.
I mean, Van Damme was definitely a player at the time. And
yeah, people were behind him. The fans, for whatever reason, when he immediately after he came in, people really wanted to see him, you know, be on top, you know.
Mm-hmm. So. And it's interesting to kind of see his fall through, into 2002, where what was he doing at WrestleMania 18 that year? Was it, I want to say it was an opening match, but I'm not absolutely sure of that one.
18, didn't he wrestle Regal?
Yeah, he beat Regal in a 7-minute opening match. So in just a few months, he was pushed down from, you know, for whatever reason this was, he was pushed down from being the guy main eventing a pay-per-view with Steve Austin to the guy opening a show with William Regal.
Yeah, and then he got the main event, kind of the main event push again, at least for like the, you know, for one pay-per-view with Triple H, and then they moved on. And then WrestleMania 19, he wasn't even on the show. He was in the Heat match with Kane and Rob Van Dam against Lance Storm and Chief Morley. So,
ooh, that one was a classic.
Chief Morley. Yeah. Yeah, they got 10 minutes apparently. So,
yeah, that's good for them in that match where Lance Storm has said on his blog, you don't get paid as much in that match. So, that's a bummer for them.
Yeah. Well, and,
You know, and if you just go by WrestleMania's, Van Damme was in a forgettable, he was tagging with Booker T in a forgettable four-way tag match at WrestleMania 20. And
that's right.
Was he even on 21?
Was he in the money?
No, he was hurt because he had to miss One Night Stand that year, too. And he cut a promo saying, this sucks worse than
missing WrestleMania. And then he would go on in 2006 at WrestleMania 22 to win Money in the Bank and have kind of his last relevant run on top.
Right, exactly. And then he was pretty much gone by 07, early 08, right?
He got written out in 2007 at some point with that awesome DDT and RKO, or no, that awesome RKO from Randy Orton that
That's right.
was sold like only Rob Van Dam can sell something.
Yeah, I will say that RVD did a nice job with stuff like that. RVD did make that stuff look good. You know, he could never do long-term selling, but he could immediately sell the impact of a move.
Yeah, he never, sold a leg through an entire match, but he could sell the impact of the move right away. And, for that RKO, all he had to do was lay there and be concussed afterwards, so he was fine.
So, good for him.
Yeah.
So, anything else you, any other discussion regarding this, or I think we've been pretty thorough.
Yeah, I think we've covered it. I can't think that anyone at home is sitting there screaming, "What about this?" to the match.
I hope it was
a really, really fantastic Elimination Chamber match, and just a well-booked and very logical match on its own.
Yeah, and amazing how well it turned out based on all the obstacles that we've learned about as well. So.
Yeah, it's one of those matches where you just go, it had no right to be as good as it was.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that it was.
Indeed. So, Will, why don't you tell, let everyone know where they can find your writing and on Twitter and that kind of thing.
Yeah, you can find my writing at prowrestling.net. I do a weekly blog on Raw and on TNA Impact. I also, for all WWE and TNA pay-per-views, usually publish a predictions column and a blog post-show as well. Also, if you're into the podcast and audio side of things for .net, for ProWrestling.net members, we have I do a weekly Impact audio recap and a weekly audio show with Jake Barnett, counting down the top five and bottom three moments every week. And occasionally those pop up on the free podcast as well. So stay tuned for that. Stay tuned for that if you want the free stuff, or you can check out ProWrestling.net to become a member of the site.
All right. Well, thanks again, Will, for being on the show.
Always fun.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Of course, you can check us out at WrestleSpective.com. And fairtoflare.com, and follow me on Twitter at WrestleSpective. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll be back again soon.